Hey everyone, this is Hannah, this is Texas 1031, and this is a Texas True Crime Podcast. Welcome to our annual Halloween episode, and we have reached our 80th episode. I actually think that I'm going to split this up into two parts. I actually tried to record this, and I did yesterday, and it was like an hour and a half long, and the audio came out weird. I think my computer speakers are blown, so it sounded fine in my headphones, but then it didn't sound fine when I played it back just on my computer, so I deleted it like a fucking idiot. But I realized it was probably too long, so I think I'm going to spread it out into two parts. We'll just kind of see. The first part might be shorter, second part might be longer. No one cares. Let's just start talking about the stuff. So I'm going to be telling you all about Daniel Lee Corwin, a little-known rapist and serial killer from Temple, Texas. We have a lot to cover, like I mentioned, so let's get into it. So picture it. Temple, Texas, let's just say in the 70s. A little background first. Danny Corwin was born in Garden Grove, California in 1958. He looked nothing like the rest of his siblings. They were darker, tan skin, brown hair. He had blue eyes, strawberry blonde hair. So he was obviously already kind of the odd man out in the group. Before I go any further, I did get all of this information from a book. Let me find it. Let's see. It is called The Demon Next Door by Brian Burra. And if you remember in my last episode, I mentioned that I stumbled upon this case through Brian Burra, who was, Anyway, he had done the Stephenville podcast, and I might have mentioned that in my last episode is what I'm trying to fucking say. And he mentioned this book. Oh my gosh, my dogs are barking. Kill me now. And I used this book to be the source for this episode. Long story fucking short. Okay. So I'm going to be referencing the book here and there. So Danny also struggled in school. He had to be held back a year in the third grade due to poor reading and comprehension skills. He was never a stellar student and would consistently struggle with his grades, usually ranging in the lower C's and D's. This kind of comes into play later in his life. Around the time of Danny's early crimes, the Corwin family lived in a ranch house on a street called Deer Trail. The house was in a development called Western Hills on the west side of Temple. The large family of six originated up north in upstate New York, where the parents, Philip and Nancy, would meet and begin their relationship. However, due to Phil's job as a factory worker, the family moved all across the United States from coast to coast before settling in Temple. The Corwins were a very religious family. They attended Temple's First Presbyterian Church pretty much weekly. If they weren't listening to a church sermon on Sundays, Philip, Nancy, and their children were all involved in church social activities as well. They did youth group events, church-hosted dinners, and they also sang in the choir. These were just kind of a few of the happenings that the family took part in. So their eldest daughter was Debbie, the second oldest was Daniel, and the two youngest were Donna and David. Very classic 70s, 80s family names and just like vibe all the way around. Early on, Danny was a pretty regular kid. He obviously, like I mentioned, he struggled in school, but he loved to express himself creatively by drawing. He enjoyed the outdoors, fishing, riding his bike, and he even played a year of football in middle school. However, the normal, independent, and average side of Danny would fade away when he was around his parents or other adults. He became somewhat obnoxious and needy, constantly seeking adult validation whenever they were around. He appeared to be incredibly dependent on his parents' approval. This people-pleasing attitude that Danny applied would score points with teachers, parents, and local adults in Temple. They all loved the kid. His politeness, obedience, and cooperation made what would happen later in Danny's life all the more bizarre and harder to accept. As he grew up, though, Danny became an odd boy. School is hard for the majority of people at some point in their adolescence, but Danny just truly never seemed to fit in. He wasn't socially extroverted or popular like his older sister Debbie. In fact, he was the total opposite, incredibly quiet and practically friendless. Danny would sit in his class using his huge hunting knife to trim and cut his nails. I'm sure that was a real thrill. Many recall Danny having a blank face with flat affect, showing little to any emotion. Danny was a bedwetter throughout his adolescence and teenage years. He constantly lied and would use deception and manipulation tactics at any given time for whatever reason he felt. This tendency would carry on into his adulthood as well. If you can hear that hacking noise in the background, that's my cat trying to dislodge a hairball as we speak. Oh my God, she sounds like she's having a asthma attack. Anyway, I'm just going to keep going. So despite Danny being good with children and taking on the role of babysitter when he was younger, when he grew up, he had trouble initiating conversations and he would just look to the ground, practically hunched over when he walked. His interactions with young girls and later on with grown women became increasingly disturbing and creepy. An incident that pales in comparison to his later crimes, but is still worth mentioning, is that as a young boy, while he was in church one day, he was caught attempting to throw a young girl over the balcony and down some stairs. Around 12 or 13, he became quite vocal about sex and his knowledge of it. On Boy Scout trips, he would just make offhanded comments about sex. And even though the other boys were in the same age and beginning to show interest in sex as well, the way Danny went about it and what he was describing just made them feel uncomfortable. Years later, rumors and hearsay would resurface about some other incidents in Danny's childhood and teenage years. One popular story was when Danny killed his older sister Debbie's cat after the two had an argument. Other stories were how Danny was actually a peeping Tom, staring into the windows of the rooms of some of his female schoolmates. Far worse, however, was the allegation that Danny had been experimenting with bestiality since he was a young boy. It was unanimous. By the time Danny reached his mid to late teens, he was a certified fucking awkward creep who made many, if not all, incredibly uncomfortable. But let's rewind a bit to when Danny was only 16 years old. On Friday, March 15th, 1974, Raymond and Gretchen Finn, who lived next door to the Corwins, asked an eighth grader, 13-year-old Kathy Choate, to babysit their infant son. After the couple left to attend their dinner and a movie date, Kathy, who was fairly new to town, took the young boy out to the front yard to play and roll a ball with him. A few hours later, when the sun went down, Kathy took the baby inside and placed him in his crib for bed. She went into the living room to turn on the television and wait out the remainder of the evening before the Finns came home. However, a couple of hours later, Kathy would hear a noise coming from a room on the other side of the house. Upon reaching the room and glancing at the sliding glass door, she realized it was open a few feet. She bravely thought nothing of it and closed and locked the door, cheerfully returning to her movie on TV. Around 11 p.m., about an hour after the sliding glass door incident, Kathy began to hear the baby cry. As she began to walk to the baby's room, she approached the darkened hallway and stepped past the primary bedroom. As she took a step past the doorframe, a naked teenager jumped from the blackness of the room, grabbing her arm. He threatened Kathy, telling her that if she screamed, he would kill her with the knife he had in his hand. The boy pushed Kathy into the bedroom, forcing her to strip off all of her clothes. Kathy's attacker took his knife and cut a piece of her t-shirt, creating a makeshift gag to keep Kathy silent. The teen shoved Kathy onto the bed, raping her at knife point. Kathy attempted to bargain with the boy, trying to talk him out of hurting her or killing her, but before she knew it, he had finished and he was allowing her to grab her clothes off of the floor. She made her way to a nearby bathroom to get dressed, but was interrupted by a soft knocking on the door. She opened it, knowing he could simply break down the door anyways. Kathy finally saw the face of her rapist. He quietly said, you have my shirt. In her haste, she had accidentally grabbed his clothing as well as her own before heading to the bathroom. I'm sorry, she said. He advised her that he lived across town and that she didn't know him and to keep it that way. The boy left the house and ran off into the night. Not long after, the Finns arrived home to find Kathy crying in the locked bathroom. Temple PD was called and soon arrived at the Finn home to assist Kathy in reporting her rape. She told the officers what happened, but she wasn't sure who had broken in and raped her. Kathy said she believed it could have been a boy from a different school on the other side of town named Speedy. However, as Raymond Finn sat listening to Kathy's summation of her attack and the description she gave of the boy who raped her, he couldn't help but think that the teenager who broke in and assaulted Kathy sounded a lot like the oldest boy who lived right next door, Daniel Corwin. A week later, a Temple officer would finally make their way to the Corwins' home to interview Danny on the matter while in the presence of his father, Philip. The questioning went fine. Danny admitted that he and his siblings were home alone the previous Friday night, but denied any involvement in Kathy's attack and rape. When asked if he would be willing to take a polygraph examination, Phil Corwin offered up Danny to the officer as willing and able. The morning after the officer spoke with Danny and his father, Kathy Choate called Temple PD with an update. She told the investigators working her case that she had actually seen her rapist at school. She realized it wasn't this speedy boy like she had originally thought, but rather it was Danny Corwin. A few days later, Danny and Phil would head to Austin, where Danny would undergo three separate polygraph exams. Unfortunately, all three were tallied and believed to be inconclusive. The administrator of the exams told police even after all three exams, he truly couldn't tell if Danny was guilty of Kathy's attack and rape or not. But just to be clear, he was guilty. Things just got more upsetting and frustrating from here. A few more days after the polygraph examinations, officers held interviews and took statements from the other Corwin siblings, as well as the surrounding neighbors of the Finn and Corwin residences. None of them could shed any light onto the night of Kathy's rape, and investigators had to tell Kathy and her family that despite their belief that Danny was the perpetrator, there just wasn't enough evidence to charge him. Additionally, the fact that Kathy originally identified the boy Speedy as her attacker didn't help matters either. Kathy's rape was never printed in the newspaper. It remained a private matter, and in the end, nothing was done and no one was brought to justice. Nancy and Phil Corwin did their best to put the incident behind them as well. They figured it was just a horrible coincidence and misunderstanding and that their son was being wrongly accused. It was relatively easy for the Corwin family to push the matter to the back of their minds, since during this time, Philip and Nancy were beginning to struggle in other more prominent ways. Phil had quit his job to start a new position at a small company that created fiberglass boats. But in July of 1974, the company failed, and Phil was suddenly unemployed. With their mortgage payments going unpaid, the family packed up and moved into a mobile home and lived on some land in Moffett, Texas, about 8 miles from Temple. Phil and Nancy stayed in the small RV while the children slept in a nearby tent. Although the move was a significant adjustment, the family made it by. The kids all enrolled at nearby schools in Belton. However, camping life actually didn't last that long. A fellow church member offered Phil Corwin a job as a maintenance worker at a local Temple hospital. By January of 1975, the Corwin children re-enrolled at the Temple schools, with Danny entering his sophomore year. During the transition between the various schools, Danny managed to lose the very few friends he had and was left heading back to high school as a relative loner. He personally would later admit to feeling extremely rejected socially. Remember, though, the rape allegations involving Kathy and Danny hadn't been made public, so Danny was being ostracized for just being fucking weird, more or less. A fellow classmate of Danny's, which was Jim Huggins, commented on Danny stating, quote, "He was just one of those guys. You'd see him and you'd just forget him," end quote. Summer break was fast approaching for the Corwin family, and on Friday, May 16th, 1975, they had a weekend trip planned with the First Presbyterian's youth group. The four children and Phil and Nancy would be attending the trip. Nancy even wrote a request for Danny to be released early that Friday around noon in preparation for the getaway. The request was granted, and Danny left school on time, having promised his father Phil he'd meet him a little while later in the afternoon. 2 hours would pass, and around this time, another 10th grader, Brenda Evans, would leave school as well, submitting her own note for early release. Brenda exited the building, heading to the parking lot. She was on her way to attend a babysitting course. With the school behind her and the massive football stadium ahead of her, she quickly walked to her car in the parking lot stationed in between the two structures. As Brenda reached her vehicle, she noticed Danny Corwin sitting on top of a car right beside her own. Brenda recognized Danny and struck up a friendly conversation with him. "Hey, Daniel, what are you doing?" "Not much," he replied. Brenda opened the door and slid into the driver's seat. As she reached for an 8-track tape before driving off, she felt and heard her door reopen again beside her. Daniel Corwin stood towering beside the young teen, holding a large hunting knife. Brenda was in shock. She had just talked to the guy, and everything seemed fine, so what was he doing? Danny forced Brenda to scoot over into the passenger seat before aggressively driving out of the parking lot. Danny drove through town, passing all of the main streets and farming fields before turning into Derby Hill, a place where the teenage boys in the area would host literal soapbox derbies. Danny finally stopped the car at an old abandoned shack near a gravel pit before turning off the car. He repeated what he had said and done with Kathy, demanding Brenda to take off her clothes. But when she wasn't moving fast enough for his liking, Danny reached across and ripped Brenda's blouse and bra off with his knife. Screaming in fear and confusion, Brenda felt helpless and braced herself for what was to come next. Danny frantically pulled off Brenda's jeans and underwear as well, throwing them into a nearby mud puddle. Danny attempted to cover her mouth and nose with his hands, all the while he was pulling her hair and jerking her head from side to side, trying to keep Brenda quiet. By the time Danny had finished raping Brenda, she began to experience and do what many women have attested to trying during the course of their own sexual assault. She felt like Danny had something else in mind, something much worse than rape. So she began to talk calmly and quietly to Danny in an effort to subside his anger and aggression. Brenda was simply trying to reason with him and hopefully talk him out of doing whatever he had planned next. "Take my car," she said. "Just leave me here, and I promise I won't tell anyone or the police what happened. Just please leave me alive." Danny thought for a moment, staying silent before getting up off of Brenda. He stepped out of the car and put his clothes back on. "Get out," he said. "No, I want my clothes," Brenda replied. After several moments of arguing with Brenda about her clothes, Danny reached into the car and grabbed her arm with every intent of yanking Brenda out of the driver's side door. Instead, Brenda kicked him straight in the dick. Danny winced in pain, throwing Brenda her dirty and muddy clothes. Brenda eagerly put her clothes back on before Danny pulled her from the car at knife point, ordering her to walk to the trunk. The trunk's door handle turned out to be broken, so Danny struggled for a moment, deciding on where he should direct Brenda next, since tossing Brenda in the trunk was suddenly botched. He pointed with his knife to the gravel pit near the car, directing her to walk towards it. Brenda resisted his demands, and the two teens began to wrestle. Both ended up on the ground in a physical fight, all the while Danny had his knife in his hand. He finally got Brenda slammed into the dirt on her back, with his knees pressing onto her arms, prohibiting her from moving the majority of her upper body. Danny took his hunting knife and shanks it straight into the fleshy part of Brenda's upper right arm. Brenda screamed in agony, yelling at Danny, asking him, "Do you know what you're doing?" "Yes, I know exactly what I'm doing," he replied. And with that, Daniel Corwin took his knife and violently sliced open Brenda's throat. With blood pouring from her neck, Brenda looked up at Danny as he stared into her eyes intently. She begged him again to just leave her alone. Danny raised his knife once more, thrusting it into her stomach. He now held the weapon high above Brenda's body, aiming it at her heart. Brenda cried out once more, begging him to not stab her in the heart, but with a sick, strange smile on his face, Danny took the tip of the knife and began to slowly press it in between the cups of Brenda's bra, gradually shoving the knife into her sternum. Suddenly, though, Danny stopped. He stood above Brenda, staring in silence as she bled more and more. Eventually, Danny grabbed an old wooden board and placed it across Brenda's face. He then took a few handfuls of dirt and mud and threw them across her feet. Lastly, he ripped up some old hay and weeds nearby and sprinkled them around her body. The entire time, though, Brenda lay completely still, somewhat hoping he thought she was dead. She couldn't see him anymore due to the board covering her face, but Brenda heard Danny throwing things from her car and then eventually heard the car's engine turn over. She assumed Danny was going to drive away, but instead he turned the car around and ran right over her. In some stroke of luck, the tires of Brenda's car missed her head by just a few feet. And with that, Danny Corwin was gone. Miraculously, after a few minutes, Brenda heaved the board off of her and was able to stand. She realized that the clasp of her bra had actually saved her life that day, preventing the knife's blade from entering her body. Her other wounds were still very serious, and she knew she didn't have much time. The first car to pass by Brenda didn't stop to help the half-naked and blood-covered teenager, but luckily the second car did. They dropped Brenda off at a gas station near the highway where Temple PD was finally called. That is very reminiscent of, what was her name? Mary. Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to look it up. If you can hear me typing. Mary Vincent. Yes, that's who it was. If you don't know about Mary Vincent, go look her up. She gets her arms chopped off and she somehow climbs up and these cars don't want to help her because she looks fucking terrifying. Anyway, immediately after leaving the scene of the attack, Danny headed out to hide Brenda's car in town. He then made his way back to the high school and around 2:45, another student, Janie Hart, actually picked up Danny and drove him a few blocks to the 31st Street Dairy Queen so he could grab a soda. All that attempted murder made him thirsty, I guess. Honestly, Janie is very fucking lucky. Like, she could have been raped and killed too, probably. So Janie then took Danny to a Dr. Pepper factory, where he claimed he was meeting up with his father later that afternoon. On the drive there, breaking news began to sing from the car's radio. Brenda's rape and attack were being reported on in real time, but Danny's name was not mentioned on the radio's recap. Back at the gas station, ambulances and police cars swarmed the building. Brenda was briefly questioned by police before getting transported to a local Temple hospital. She immediately identified Danny as her attacker and rapist and gave them an overview of what had happened. In the crowd of police officers was Kenneth Miller. He was one of the men investigating Kathy Choate's rape just a year prior. After hearing Brenda's version of what happened to her that afternoon, Miller decided to head on over to the Corwins' old home in Western Hills, not realizing that the family had moved a year earlier. When no one answered the door, Miller went next door to the Finn's house, where he learned that the Corwins were no longer living in the neighborhood. Miller then went down to the bank that Nancy Corwin was working at to see if she could be of some help with locating her son. When Miller caught up with Nancy, she was standing outside the bank with one of her daughters. The duo was about to leave and meet up with Phil and Danny for the youth group trip. After Miller explained what had occurred and that he needed to speak with Danny, Nancy offered to show him the way out to Moffitt. The three piled into his vehicle and made their way down I-35. Closing in on the turnoff to Moffitt, Miller sees ahead a brown station wagon. This, Nancy confirmed, was the family's vehicle, probably occupied by her husband and her other daughter who were heading to the church for the weekend trip. However, sitting proudly in the driver's seat, speeding away, was Daniel Corwin. He was heading in the direction of Temple's airport. After a small chase that lasted a few miles, Danny pulled off to the side of the highway and was finally handcuffed and taken back to the police station. He was booked and then transported to the Bell County Jail. Meanwhile, Brenda's car was located behind the Temple auction barn and the gravel pit was sectioned off as the crime scene. Shockingly, the Temple media was relatively silent on the matter. This was mainly due to the fact that Brenda and Danny were both minors, so coverage on the attack was vague in the details. However, the town itself was buzzing with conjecture and questions, primarily between Brenda and Danny's fellow peers. It wasn't the typical questions and statements made after a crime like, "We never thought he could be capable of this," or "How could this have happened?" or "What did Brenda do to set him off?" Rather, people questioned how they didn't see this attack coming and why they couldn't have, you know, prevented it. As a town in a high school, they felt like they let Brenda down and were very angry with Danny. Quite the opposite reaction of a southern town in the 1970s, originally, is kind of what I thought, but this sentiment didn't last long at all. Daniel Corwin spent 30 days in the county jail before being released on a $10,000 bond. His family and family friends chalked up Danny's involvement in the crime to yet just, you know, another bizarre mix-up and misunderstanding. In their mind, there was no way, obviously, that he could have attacked and raped Brenda. Interestingly, Danny would confide in a prison psychologist that during this time in jail, he would actually be raped by a fellow inmate. He never went necessarily into detail about the incident, and there was never really evidence or hard proof proving that the rape occurred, but he still claimed it happened nonetheless. So setting up for the trial against Daniel Corwin was going to be interesting, to say the least. District Attorney Joe Carroll, who was only 30 years old at the time, was ready to take on the case and defend the state's position. Surprisingly, Daniel's family was also preparing their defense as well. They had something in their corner that held extreme sway, power, and money in the community, and I bet you can guess what it is. Yeah, they had the First Presbyterian Church. The church's minister, Wilson Keenan, connected the Corwins with two very influential people in Temple. Number one was the mayor, Jamie Clements, and number two was Frank Mayborn. He ran the town's radio station, the newspaper, and the nearby television station as well. So essentially, the Corwins had politics and the media at their disposal. The group would meet at the church for strategy sessions regarding Danny's charges and upcoming trial. This partnership, it definitely divided the church to a certain extent, which I kind of assumed would be the case. So there were some members who didn't think Danny should be allowed to attend services. In fact, they wanted the entire Corwin family shunned from the institution entirely. These members wholeheartedly believed in his guilt. However, there were others who felt that whatever Danny had done had no reflection on the rest of the Corwin children or their parents, and Danny deserved and was entitled to a defense just as much as the next person. They believed this approach was the more Christian way of thinking, and that Danny's alleged crimes were simply a test of the community's faith in God. Shocker, waves of doubt and rumor about Brenda spread across the church and really just throughout all of Temple. The general opinion was that either Danny fucked up and just needed some counseling rather than prison time, or that Brenda was a big fat slut who lured Danny into a sticky situation where he obviously had to rape, stab, and slit her throat to get out of it. You know how that goes, right? I'm sure most men can relate. Actually, so to be fair, the rumors spread because the gruesome details weren't made public, so in turn, people just kind of had to speculate. I'm sure if they actually knew what he did, the slut-shaming, victim-blaming narrative would potentially be less than it was, but who knows? People fucking suck. So according to the book I used, like I mentioned, as the main source for this episode, it was common for everyone at the time to call Brenda a whore to her face, behind her back, whatever, and that whatever happened to her was deserved and that she was not blameless in the matter. I can't even imagine having to live through that. So when it came to the trial, Danny would be prosecuted by Bob Odom. Years later, Bob would recall how countless people of Temple contacted his office asking him to not prosecute Danny. He even said that several employees within his office did the same thing. Like, that's just crazy. I don't know. Anyway, so former FBI agent Jerry Seacrest would take on the role of Danny's defense attorney. He believed that based on Brenda's statements as well as the evidence, the case would be a difficult one to defend, and let alone win. Seacrest had actually been a neighbor of the Corwins when they had lived in town. Danny had even mowed this guy's lawn, during which time he recalled Danny maybe spoke 10 words to him, fucking weird and, you know, quiet as usual. He didn't trust Danny on the stand or really in any aspect of the trial. Furthermore, when Seacrest sent Danny to Waco for another polygraph test, I mean, different victim, but again, a polygraph test, he shockingly passed. However, when the administrator lied, telling Danny that he actually failed, Danny broke down and he told the truth and admitted what he had done to Brenda. Jerry Seacrest and Bob Odom both staunchly believed that a jury would find Danny guilty. They also believed he would be sentenced to life. But none of this happened. The reason why he would never see a jury or get sentenced to life in prison for rape and attempted murder was large in part to the pride and joy of many small Texas towns, the First Presbyterian Church. So the condensed version is this. A small mob of church higher-ups and members went to Bob Odom and said, "Hey, if you don't dismiss this case or just give Danny some probation, we are going to socially crucify Brenda and ruin her reputation." But like, I mean, at this point, they kind of already had. But Bob stood strong and more or less said, fuck off. He knew that this attitude primarily stemmed, like I mentioned, from the fact that these people didn't really know the details and what actually happened. They just thought that she was, you know, basically a tease, led him on, and he had to do what he had to do. Classic, you know, story. But he also knew that he had to have Brenda's full cooperation and testimony to really hit a home run and get Danny sent to prison. But when Brenda's father learned that his daughter was going to have to be subjected to such scrutiny and trauma, he refused to allow Brenda to testify or be cross-examined. They briefly went back and forth on plea deals, trying to avoid a full-on trial, but they finally landed on Seacrest entering Danny into a guilty plea with a request for a hearing for sentencing solely before a judge. This was done with the hope that the judge would prescribe some sort of psychological treatment rather than prison time. But the two-day hearing ended with the judge saying, "Fuck you," and sentenced Daniel Corwin to 40 years in prison. And I think that I'm going to pause here and make you guys come back tomorrow, I guess, for part two. And we'll continue on with his later crimes. So yeah, tune in tomorrow for part two. I don't have anything of this written in my script, so I don't really know what to say. What do I normally say? I thank you all so much for listening. I will be back with more Texas True Crime. And if anyone is listening, happy Halloween. See you tomorrow.